Hello, this is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, a live stream broadcast I've been doing most Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays during the pandemic, as long as I can't travel and play music for a living anymore. I'm also broadcasting on Mondays and Tuesdays. Mondays, I host Pandemic Open Mic Mondays, which anyone with a song, poem, or rant is encouraged to sign up for at davidrovics.com/POMM. Tuesdays, I host Fifth Estate Live, produced by Peter Werby. All of these live stream broadcasts start at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT, approximately, every weekday. And you can find them both live in an archived form on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KBOO Community Radio, and my own Facebook pages and channels on YouTube, Periscope, Twitch, VK, and LinkedIn. If you go to davidrovics.com or search on any podcasting platform for the podcast This Week with David Rovics, you can also find these programs in audio form soon after they're broadcast live. Another place you can find the broadcasts, along with lots of free content as well as content reserved only for patrons, such as my 16-part audio memoir, is at patreon.com/davidrovics. Today's guest has been a local here in Portland, Oregon, since he left Minneapolis in the early 1990s, where he was, among other things, a co-founder of Anti-Racist Action. Mike is a brilliant hip-hop artist who has recorded a whole bunch of albums and a lot of really good videos on YouTube. He has recorded with other artists who you may have heard of, such as Dead Prez, and he's toured in various formations in many different parts of the world, including all over Africa. Since 2015, he's been co-manager of KBOO Community Radio, just off Burnside Boulevard here in Portland. Mike, welcome back to my live stream show, if I can find the right button here. Hello.
Hey, David. What's up?
Mike, it's been it's been almost exactly a month since we last talked, and right. It's been a fair amount of activity has been going on all over the place in the past month. I mean, I can't even, I totally lost track of the number of cars that have run into protesters. And but here in Portland last weekend, a protester was shot in the face by a tear gas canister and critically injured. And now we got federal officers roaming around downtown, snatching people off the streets. Yeah, I thought maybe we could start there.
I mean, this is surreal, but we have so many opportunities to realize we're not in a fantasy, we're not in a dream, it's not a movie. All you got to do is go a few blocks in any direction. I saw, there's a police union organizing facility not too far from my house, less than a mile. And so that's been the scene of a couple major protests that were declared riots recently. The young man who was shot between the eyes with a projectile of some sort and needed reconstructive surgery for merely holding up a speaker, you know, that was broadcasting music. And then the unmarked vans and SUVs where these Homeland Security officers are driving around and doing targeted arrest, which basically could be abduction. So, you know, when I don't know what the law says, what federal law or local law says, but when somebody approaches you and doesn't declare themselves as an officer of the law, you might perceive them as a violent threat to your existence, especially if they're armed and unidentified. they're wearing hats, camouflage uniforms, head to toe, and face covering. Now, this same thing was attempted in Minneapolis. And from what I heard, in Minneapolis, the neighborhood defense, the community defense formations immediately assumed that these guys were white supremacists because there was a time when Philando Castile had been murdered by police out there, and the protests that followed, white supremacists in military fatigues were patrolling and harassing people from vehicles full of them, and a few people were shot and critically injured by white supremacists. So this was a familiar scenario in Minneapolis. So the order amongst the community defense formations was to shoot first. So Minneapolis, the feds tried this, and they were being shot at, and they left it alone. They suspended that operation. And
when was this? What period are we talking about? Just recently?
So a few years back when Philando Castile was murdered and people
Castile was murdered, right?
Okay. Well, yeah. So people occupied the North Precinct, and white supremacists came down there and shot people, and critically injured a few protesters. So now, since George Floyd's murder, community defense formations have manifested in Minneapolis. And when the feds tried to come in their unmarked cars with their military fatigues, community defense shot at them without question. Because in their mind, they're like, we're not going to have this anymore.
And they looked identical, basically, a bunch of white people in camo with guns and unmarked vans. That's very much like the look, right?
And it's ironic, but it's also very appropriate. It's like, are these neo-Nazis or are they state Nazis?
The main difference being that if they're from the state, then they basically have immunity to do anything they want to. And if they're not, then they might possibly get arrested for shooting people.
And some of us could argue that there's an unwritten immunity that the white supremacists operate under. And often the only time that they are held accountable is when there's a mass social movement after somebody already lost their life. You see? So it's an interesting time, but the fact that people were able to respond in a militant way and actually have an effect, and those people bugged out. Now, I'm assuming the feds are still in Minneapolis, but they're not that particular operation. They've abandoned because it was going to be too much of a risk for them.
So they picked Portland.
So they're here. Who knows how many cities? Because I heard about this happening in other cities. People have been posting about it on Twitter, and it was presented with a degree of fear and uncertainty. Therefore, we didn't know if it was people fear-mongering and spreading misinformation or disinformation, because it sounds like something that should only happen in the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany, right?
Kind of dictatorship, like and it's like the classic, like the white vans that would pick up people, like Tamil people in Sri Lanka. Of course, if it's somebody in a white van coming to get you, then they're from the state and they're coming to abduct you and torture you.
Right.
And if for some reason, white vans seem to be like the MO for fascist dictatorships. I don't know if that's a coincidence or.
Well, these guys are, I've seen pictures of the vans and the SUVs, and they're not always white. I don't know if they're literally just rental cars from local branches of car rental agencies, or if they're these vehicles that get moved. There was a meme I posted on Facebook that actually has the license plate numbers and descriptions of the videos that have been seen abducting people, videos of vehicles of various types with the license plates number. There's a lot of Washington plates and a lot of California plates on these vehicles that the feds are using.
Very interesting. And
it's fascinating in such a dark way, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's like, it's not like the local Portland police weren't being brutal enough as it was. I mean, they were already getting lots of criticism from all kinds of quarters that aren't normally so critical of the police. Like, you know, and of course, I'm curious what you think also about the way the city council is. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of both positive and negative things being said about Ted Wheeler and how he is dealing with this situation. And I just don't see the positive side of some people that have been praising his actions. I mean, nice to say that the federal troops are not welcome in town, but taking the tear gas away from the police and being clear that the police are constantly engaging in collective punishment of people who are guilty of nothing but taking the street.
Yeah, I heard the woman whose son was the one who got shot between the eyes and needed reconstructive surgery was at one of the protests up here in North Portland on Lombard at the police facility, and the police were actually laughing at her. making fun of her. But, you know, in terms of, you know, there was a recent article about how Governor Kate Brown was, I guess, annoyed, you know, and tweeted something in response to Trump and the chief of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, ordering these feds to be here. She wasn't happy about it. So the only positive thing that I can see, and there was a sheriff too, who said that he wouldn't work with the Homeland Security faction. And I guess the only positive that I could see from that is that there's a power struggle amongst members of the local establishment and against the federal power structure, right? That those two entities are having some type of, I don't know what you call it, egotistical territorial beef or something around who should be in control. The way that Trump goes after local officials in different cities and talks about how they better handle the situation before he has to handle it. That's a weird level of pageantry that I could never be compelled to pick a side on. Right. My only hope is that they can damage each other while they struggle. I mean, I get the territoriality of like, this is my house. You can't come into my house and tell me what to do. But the reality is none of those people are doing anything but protecting private property in the interests of the elite. So.
And it was interesting when I heard Governor Brown was on the same show that you were on just a couple weeks ago, actually, except she had the whole hour and you had like the last 30 seconds, you know, which shows exactly what they think of you and the governor, I think. But but she was on for the whole hour, and I think the news about the unmarked vehicles picking people up and stuff was basically new, and it didn't sound like she had heard about it or believed it if she had heard about it. But but OPB, I guess, is being credited with breaking the story in terms of like in such a way that other, you know, news outlets are picking it up now, which doesn't mean they broke it. Actually, it just means that, you know, other news outlets trust the opinion of the journalist who says this is happening. But right. Brown said basically her response when Dave Matthews mentioned what was going on was just to condemn all the violence, by which she clearly meant the violence, as she calls it, of the protesters. And, you know, she's saying this violence has to stop. You know, and it's, and then, of course, she goes on after that to talk about how sympathetic she is to the cause, and which, of course, is really hard to believe coming from somebody who presides over a state that, well, I mean, it's, I think what is it, somebody, the, I think the press, some press outlet just pointed out only last week that the average black family in the United States cannot afford a two bedroom apartment in Portland at the market rate, which I think says a lot about what Governor Brown actually thinks of the black lives. You know, if it's for, you know, I mean, this is her response, is to condemn the protesters again.
Yeah, I mean, none of this is surprising. We know that for as complex as things might get and as intersectional as they might get, as far as all the different layers that are converging as part of a social movement, the bottom line is the state represents an oppositional and oppressive force to the people. And the people we've got to figure out how we can work together to create the type of world we all deserve. But that's not easy. It's not an easy task, you know? And even, I know there are power struggles within movement circles around, you know, should people be focused on reform? Should people be focused on radical revolutionary strategies to achieve some type of revolution that would transform the whole of society and get rid of capitalism once and for all? Or should we be focused on doing things like trying to defund the police and redistribute to social services, because those type of things would be less likely to scare people away from being part of a movement? And just those arguments destroy relationships within movement circles. And so I just try to encourage people to not fight each other in public, and remind people that we need to work these things out in private and not on social media. There were these struggles, you know, they're going to be central to a lot of the work that we do. But we don't need to tear each other apart because we don't agree on things, you know?
In terms of the intersectionality that is, I mean, it just seems like by every week the what's going on across this country takes on more characteristics of intersectionality, like that you more and more connections being made that are just kind of obvious connections, but they're being made in a big and sometimes very eloquent way by a lot of people all at the same time. Like the connection between, like, I mean, the if then statements that are constantly coming out, like, you know, if Black Lives Matter, then what about affordable housing? You know, what if Black Lives Matter, then we need universal healthcare. These kinds of things are being said much better than I'm saying them right now, but, you know, by a lot of people in a lot of different ways. And I wonder, I think noticing this, and I wonder what your feedback is on some of these intersections that are going on.
I mean, it's beautiful. It's, again, and I think I touched on this when we talked last month, for the first time in my life, the amount of discussion in the discourse, the national discourse, even mainstream media, although I'm a little worried because I'm starting to see the focus on Black Lives Matter being kind of like evolving out of the news cycle, you know, and we understand that this is deliberate, you know, but I wonder how much something being front and center is effective at influencing the discourse that we get to have in our communities and on the streets. And when things start to fade from the media in the public eye, does that help influence people in a way to think that they might start to think it's time to move on? And so that concerns me. But the question has always been, David, what do we do beyond the moment? You know, in order for our movement to matter, it has to be connected to historic forms of struggle on a continuum, and it has to continue beyond the heat of the moment. And so that is the real question that will be less exciting to look at for a lot of people. And it might not be something we really see at demonstrations, even though individuals and collectives of people who are doing that work might show up at demonstrations. But back to your question, like the fact that people are connecting the dots in such a huge way and in such a visible way in the media is wonderful, because we get to see the connections to the root systems of oppression that have resulted. There was I wish I could figure out who it was, but there was a woman on cable the other day who was talking about exactly that the systems and the interests that created private property and capitalism and waged genocidal wars for extraction were the same forces that created the financial institutions and the political power base that protects them today. And so that there, we need to start to understand that police activity and private property are part of the same structure. And that when the filthy rich are given unimaginable amounts of resources and security to protect their private property, what you're going to find is you're going to find workers getting paid less money. You're going to find more and more masses of people who don't even have a roof over their heads. You're going to find a system where there is no health care available for poor people.
And it really, yes, that was, she was wonderful. I think you're talking about Professor Akbar, who was on Democracy Now!, and she wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. I was sharing widely. It was fantastic.
Yeah, okay,
was,
I'm gonna look for the op-ed then.
And this whole and tying it all to private property and to housing the way she was. That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's just, and then every day, certainly every week, sometimes every day, depending on whether it's the beginning of the month, end of the month, middle of the month, you know, it goes in waves. But if you walk around Portland, you find more and more large pieces of furniture on the sidewalk. And it seems like for every couch on the sidewalk I come across, that you can figure that's another 10 tents in the nearest tent city that are going to be up. It's really a picture, a sort of a dystopic kind of picture that is hard to even communicate to a lot of people in a lot of parts of the world where people don't have to live in tents with no sanitation in the middle of wealthy cities. It's a kind of an unusual American phenomenon.
Yeah, it's all over out here on the outskirts of town.
Increasingly cities, too, right?
Tent cities and whole areas where there are villages of cars and RVs that people are living out of.
Mike, you're a fantastic hip hop artist, and I've been in the videos that are up on YouTube. There's just a lot of great stuff, which I'm sure is just a fraction of the songs you've put out, I assume, because it's a big production to make a video, and you've worked with some really good producers, whoever your team is for putting these things on.
Thank you.
Like, we're in the middle of, here we are in the middle of a pandemic where musicians are unable to tour in any kind of way, recognizable way. But it's, and this is getting a lot of attention in the media. They talk, you know, about how all the unemployed musicians, all the unemployed restaurant workers who often were also the same unemployed musicians, you know, who were also working in restaurants because Spotify wasn't paying enough to buy the groceries, let alone pay the rent. You know? But, but the whole, trying to put the kind of, work that people like you and I do as performers in context is hard because we're kind of starting out with in the context of an industry that basically already collapsed like years ago, right? Depending on where you measure the collapse, you know.
Seriously, yeah.
I mean, did you actually start performing and touring before the music industry collapsed, like before 1997 or so, or it's all been after?
You know, I started performing in 1993 as an independent hip hop artist. And, you know, the idea then was get exposure and get recognition and build an audience and then get a record deal. Well, I never got a record deal. So for close to 30 years, you know, I've been an independent artist. And the degree to which I've been able to do some touring, David, and go be part of projects in other countries in Africa, you know, Germany, Russia, Cuba, has all been independent because the music industry, for whatever reasons, and this is a long conversation, but there's a lot of speculation, not a lot of clarity, but the speculation is an informed speculation. If you look at the art and the political nature of the art that I do, that has been consistently on message, you know, for decades, it's not the kind of work that gets commercial support from a record industry. And there used to be a lot more frustrating for me, but because I've been at it for so many decades, just like you, I've had to find a way. And I have found a way. I'm not rich because I do music, but I'm able to continue to carve enough time to continue to create. And it's healing for me, honestly. I mean, the real reason I continue to be an artist, David, is because I feel like I haven't done my best work yet. That's what keeps me going. It's, you know, money comes at times and at other times money doesn't come, and I have to do other things that are an extension of the work I do with music, like work in schools as an educator or a teaching artist in residence. And that's okay with me to have to put all those things together. That said, when I started rhyming as an independent artist fronting for a band called Hungry Mob in 1993 in Portland, there was a lot. I mean, hip hop was and still is popular, right? There were a lot of smaller independent record labels with distribution deals with major record labels all over the country. And a lot of artists were getting signed from different communities all over the country. Different regions were getting more popular because of their hip hop. And I watched people I know get record deals, whether they were independent or closer to the majors. But I could never really get close to that. And then sometime in the late 90s, things started to shift and we understood that there were less resources for developing artists into superstars, less resources to go around to be invested in artists' careers coming from the big companies. And eventually the rise of the Wi-Fi music distribution and accessibility to the consumer created a shift in things and where it became less cost effective for the major labels to have these 6-7 figure budgets for artists that they would front to the artists, and then the artists would have to go out and make all that money back. And if they were lucky enough, they were able to pay back their debt to the record company and continue to make enough profit to sustain, reinvest in their career and even maybe be rich or whatever, right? And that's the model of success that's been paraded in front of us as what the dream that the musician has, is that if I can only do that, and that's why they moved to LA or moved to New York or whatever. But that's never been the reality for me. And so the crash that we've seen happen has forced us to be more resilient and more creative and diversify the way that we get after work. And now in this time, this current crash that we're witnessing, where the venues, the actual, you know, food and beverage houses that we used to perform in are not available because of the pandemic. And so we're being forced to dig deeper into the online platforms, right?
And meanwhile, like, yeah, so you can't do, you do gigs and tour, but you can, you know, and you can do the online stuff. Yeah. But then right. Also not only all of that is true, but even way before the pandemic hit, without a record deal of any kind, if you recorded an album, like back when you were starting, for at least for the first 10 years or so in the 90s and beginning of this century, if you recorded an album, that meant putting out a physical recording of some kind. And that right. meant that if people wanted to hear your music, at least until 99 or so, totally, they're going to buy a CD. I mean, or they're going to copy one from somebody else, but that was going to be an effort that required sticking a cassette player, a cassette into a tape deck and getting a shitty copy made. And, you know, I mean, it was a whole different world, which at the time seemed kind of easy. Like, oh, piracy is so easy. You just have to stick a cassette into a cassette player and press play and then wait around for 2 hours, you know? But, you know, now that seems like a ridiculous amount of effort, right? But, but the fact was that even without a record deal, and I know that you were fairly immersed in all sorts of different DIY music scenes, both hip hop and all sorts of other music in Minneapolis as well. Like, I mean, it was the standard thing was you recorded an album of some kind, even if it was just a self-made cassette, but CDs became very popular because they were so cheap and easy to produce. And then you sold them at shows and you could make money, but that whole model collapsed like long, long time ago, right? But yeah, did you ever have any luck with that model of just ignoring the industry and just making copies of a record and traveling on that?
Yeah, I did. I persisted through a lot of willful ignorance as far as like what the standard path was supposed to be and what I was doing. I was always behind, David. I didn't start my career until I was 23, you know? And to me, now 23 sounds young, but as an artist that's trying to be a professional rapper in the genre of hip hop, commercial hip hop, right? 23 is actually kind of old. So I still print physical CDs.
Do you?
I do, because I like, I actually am attached to the concept of having a tangible object that has artwork on it and liner notes. I just, there's something about it I love. It's not the smartest investment, but I do sell them. Every time I perform, I still sell CDs. I do small batches. So a small batch, you know, a run of like 200 to 300 CDs isn't as cost effective as a larger batch, because the more you buy, the more units you buy and put into production, the cheaper it is to produce them, right? But I get a CD done for about maybe somewhere between $1.50 and $2 a piece. And if I turn around and I sell that for $5 to $10, I make a profit, you know, and it's decent. The challenge is figuring out how to not get too many, because there's been a few times where we bought too many. Like we'd invest in 1,000 copies of a record, but then we'd end up after 2 years, the record's no longer new. No one's writing about it anymore. And so you just have these boxes of heavy boxes of CDs that you don't know if you're ever going to sell or not. And so you got to find a place to store them and so on and so forth. But I do enjoy physical, tangible merchandise items. T-shirts, beautiful things. You know, if the artwork is good, big shout out to Roger Pete from Just Seeds. Amazing artist. He's collaborated with me on album art for my last few CDs, as well as some T-shirt designs. And I was recently able to make a lot of money doing a concert for this series called Front Porch PDX, where people in Portland donate their front porch of their home, and we go out there and we perform and live for a local crowd of socially distanced fans. And then as they live stream the show, we've got information for our Venmo or our Patreon or whatever it is, whatever way we want to receive donations. And we made great money. And okay, I had
it live streams on their platform. Is that on Front Porch PDX's platform? That's where.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, it is a YouTube. Mm-hmm. I need to figure that out. But I'm actually going to start playing a deeper role in helping curate some of these concerts, because what happened was there were two Front Porch concerts happening at the same time in North Portland, and people were upset because they wanted to be at these concerts that were happening in two different locations. So one of the ideas we're talking about, and we have to further develop this, nothing's set in stone, but we're going to try to do something where the concerts are staggered, and then maybe people can be encouraged to move from one house to the next. But we do want to be mindful and respectful of social distancing. I say all that to say that even though one aspect of the industry has become more difficult, there are still ways that we're going to innovate and continue to work. And I'm happy about that.
Yeah. And I mean, in terms of the number of people actually playing music and using the internet to play music and to hear music. And I mean, it's probably never, I'm sure it's never been better. But in terms of anybody, surviving off of that, I don't know if it's never been worse, but it hasn't been, you know, it's pretty bad. I mean, in terms of, you know, it's because now with people's expenses are so much higher is another thing that as the music industry has collapsed, as with so many other industries, the expenses of your average, you know, artist or restaurant worker or both, you know, has doubled, tripled, you know, so it's,
yeah. And we're in kind of a bubble of uncertainty right now. You know, people are surviving off of these stimulus checks and unemployment, but nobody, there's masses of people who don't know when they're going to be able to go back to work.
Yeah, incidentally, I've been trying to get on Oregon's unemployment since April, and I call the number every day, and it's busy. And today, for the first time, I was almost going to think, oh, maybe I'll have to delay, you know, postpone the interview with Mike, because for the first time, an hour before we started talking, I got through. There wasn't a busy signal. And I called many times a day for months. The first time, no busy signal. So I got this really long message in English and then a really long message in Spanish. And it's supposed to be at the end of the message, you wait to talk to somebody. And they said that at the end of the message, right? And then after the Spanish version of the message concluded, I got cut off.
So
that was my one experience with them actually picking up the line.
I'm sorry that happened to you. It's like
I can only laugh about it, you know. The failed state nature of this country and this state is just astonishing.
Were you walking around the house screaming "fuck" for a couple minutes though?
I got over that a while ago. I have no expectation of succeeding with these people, but I'm not in the situation where I'm like selling my instruments to pay. You know, I mean, I'm just, I'm, you know, I'm doing all right with Patreon and stuff like that. So it's I'm not in the situation that we're hearing about from so many other people, but of course, you know, it's terrible. But I mean, you're hearing about it all the time. And it's very interesting how the business press is sometimes like Noam Chomsky always would say that if you want to know what's really happening in a country, pay more attention to the business press than to the main articles on, you know, because the business press, they have to tell people like Forbes is now saying the stock market is probably about to collapse. They're not saying that everywhere, you know. They're painting a rosy picture of the future. I mean, all the politicians, they don't want to talk about the stock market's about to collapse, but the business press, they have to say that because they got investors reading this stuff. They need to, you know, they need to be responsible to their investor readers. You know, they're not general public publications, right? So, yeah, it's interesting things coming up.
I'm busier than I've ever been, David, and my challenge now is looking at the question of how long do I get to sustain the level of activity that I'm being called to right now? And the other question is, how do I effectively prioritize all the demands that are coming in right now? A lot of it isn't paid work, but it's work that brings me a ton of exposure because I get asked to 3 times a week sometimes to perform and speak at protests that have a large audience, larger audiences than some of the venues I was used to performing in. And because the music and the message in the speaking is in alignment with the movement, I'm walking away from each of those experiences with, I think, long-term fans and supporters of my work. And so this is good for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And speaking of which, tomorrow in Lentz Park, what's going on?
There's a demonstration in support of Black Lives Matter. There was a young man, Dominique Dunn, who was shot and killed here a week ago in a parking lot of a strip club. And when it first went on the internet, people were posting about it. It was reported as a white supremacist attack because the white man who shot and killed Dominique Dunn called him nigger before he shot and killed him. But what's unclear is how aligned with white supremacist hate this man was and how much the word nigger was used in frustration and how much he was just an ignorant white boy who listened to a lot of rap music and might have hung around people that said that. And therefore he said it himself, which is a phenomenon. And so I say that to say that there's not clarity amongst people who might have witnessed or been around what happened as to whether this was a normal, and I don't mean to belittle the loss of life at all, but whether this was a normal occurrence that might have happened on any other night during any other time in the life of people in the city going to the club and getting in an altercation, or whether this is something that was heightened or somehow influenced by the national climate of racial tension. Regardless of all that, the man's life was lost in gun violence, and in respect, you know, and in an effort to honor the loss of his life, there is a rally for Black Lives Matter because his Black life did matter. It does matter. And that's going to be at Lentz Park starting at 6 o'clock tomorrow. I'll be performing sometime between 6 and 8:30. That's what I know. I think there'll be other artists. I'm not on the flyer. I've shared the flyer on my social media. at Mike Crenshaw, MICCRENSHOW on Instagram and Twitter. But I'll be out there. Lentz Park historically has been a place where white supremacists feel real comfortable. You know, the deep Southeast, what we would call the numbers out in the East County, has historically been poor white working class area. And in the 80s and 90s, we know that Eastside White Pride, a white supremacist gang, other organizations, were that was their home. You know, that's where that was their base of operation. And there was a lot of racial terror in those areas. And so now, through forced displacement, resulting from gentrification, black populations that used to live in North and Northeast Portland have been pushed out into that area. And there's been reports of violence where there have been racist attacks on black people in Lentz Park and in the surrounding communities. And so this rally is going to be in support of black communities and black lives and people of color who live out there, who have to deal with this climate of racism.
You know, I was totally unfamiliar with that sort of outer Southeast neighborhood until just a couple months ago when I went out there to post flyers about rent striking and eviction resistance. And I went out there specifically because my landlord, the Randall Group, owns a big apartment complex out there. So I wanted to hit that area around there. And it's a scary place. Some of that, I mean, that neighborhood, as a guy walking around in a kilt at the time, I was feeling like, even as a middle-aged white guy, just wearing the kilt, I was feeling like I really made a bad choice of clothing for that neighborhood. It was a hot day, but, the smaller the house, the bigger the flag. I mean, in that, it was really just one of those really classic, I felt like I could have been, I don't know, anywhere in Alabama or wherever. I mean, it was just so much, so many displays of a patriotic hostility, you know.
It's America out there, you know. And what we see, I mean, you've traveled a lot in Europe, right?
Yeah.
You know, I haven't spent much time in Europe, but I've spent enough time some places in Europe, big urban areas, that I've seen housing projects that have poor white people living in them, who have the same mannerisms and characteristics of black and brown people who might live in housing projects here in the United States. But I think in the United States, we're not used to seeing and understanding that people who have white skin can live in a ghetto. In the same way that we see ghettos appear geographically in the United States.
But we don't call them ghettos, huh? We call them trailer parks. But
exactly. So when we're in this part of Portland that you're talking about, the national identity of the working class white folks out there is something that I think is related to class. And there's often been a discussion amongst some of my communist comrades around, you know, the movement towards revolution has to be one that focuses on the class commonalities that we all share, as opposed to the racial disparities that can potentially break us into silos. And so we need to understand that the poor working class white person is objectively revolutionary, and they're just as opposed to the establishment and the system and the ruling class as we are. And that's just such a critical question to like continue to struggle with, because the reality is a lot of poor white people in this society do not see themselves as the class allies of people of color and oppressed people and black people that are marginalized by capitalism. They're often in alignment with the capitalist structure that exploits them. And often are used as a militant buffer between the possibility of social revolution and transformation of this system. They're a buffer between us and the elite. And they often become the fascist forces that we have to fight in the street.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Right. And that consciousness that you're talking about is so often emphasized by people like William Barber, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's other, you know, voices, radical voices coming out of, you know, Cornel West, I mean, Martin Luther King. So many people emphasize that point that you've just made. And yet, one of the things that in terms of like corporate news coverage, one of the things I have to note is you don't hear that point being made on NPR. You know, you hear people talking about current and historic racism a lot on NPR these days, but you don't hear that point being made. And I wonder why. And I wonder if that's intentional on their part, or, you know, where's William Barber when it comes to NPR? Why aren't they having people like him? You know, I mean, I can, you know, it's easy enough to answer that. But why do you never hear the voice of people like Cornel West on NPR? He's a Princeton professor, for Pete's sake. I mean, you know, he's got enough credibility, you would think, that he could be treated as one of the go-to voices of intellectuals to talk about all kinds of issues with, but it's hardly ever.
Lines are being drawn, you know, and it just depends on where you focus. You know, there's a so-called liberal base of people in this country who vote Democratic, but who are predominantly white, who consider themselves to be progressive. And they're just as much invested in the status quo as some of the people who we would call alt-right or fascist. And they don't want to lose what they have. And they're not going to be explicit about what it is that they have, but what they have is a degree of privilege that's ensured by whiteness and their allegiance to and support of the economic structure and the political system. Their allegiance to and support of the police that are going to protect their private property, their fear of crime and danger
mm-hmm.
is what compels them to kind of stay in the middle, so to speak. And they might have voted for Obama, and maybe they didn't vote for Trump, but they sure enough would have voted for Hillary, and they're going to try to influence me to vote for Joe Biden. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm not ignorant of that, you know, and that's what it is. And because of that, we still have a long way to go in the space between here and where we're trying to arrive.
Oh, yeah.
Is going to be a level of fascism that involves people in unmarked cars kidnapping and abducting people. And it's already happening. And so I don't know how much worse it's going to get, but I do know it's going to get worse, man.
And also in between here and where we want to go, like, for example, say, defunding the police and instituting actually affordable housing, perhaps mm-hmm. abolishing forced eviction as a practice anywhere in the country. I mean, getting to places like that, especially when we're talking about defunding the police, or, you know, when we're talking about, you know, housing issues, because we got so many, so-called mom and pop landlords among that vast white, so-called middle class, or whatever we, you know, however we're defining these. Of course, very few white people will ever refer to themselves as poor in this country or working class, right? They're always middle class or lower middle class. And I'd bet all those people with those big American flags in that neighborhood out there that I was staple gunning around, who didn't want their children to even look at me, you know, right. There's going to be, people are afraid of, they're afraid of much of the population. I mean, that ultimately, right, there's a huge number of people who are actually afraid of a significant portion of the rest of the population, and they're afraid of their neighbors, and mm-hmm. and if that's that's a terrible place to start. I mean, that has to be overcome.
You know, and two questions come up, man. Many questions come up. One is, okay, so if you're afraid of your neighbors or your new neighbors, because there goes a neighbor, your neighborhood's changing, there's more brown people, some of these people were wearing hijabs, oh my God. You know, it's like, well, if you look at the TV, you're going to be told that those people are terrorists and they're gang members and whatever else. But if you just go talk to those people, you might discover that you do have some common interests. And that maybe there could be some friendships that develop, and that maybe there could be some mutual aid that emerges in time of crisis, and that is based on trust and understanding. Maybe. But if you are that scared of your neighbors, who are you going to call? You're going to call the police, right? Because they're the ones who are there to protect you from the threat of your neighbors. When the police come, what's going to happen? So right now, what we have is we have two possibilities. We have the possibility for us to develop some type of coherent cohesion and build community, or we have the opportunity to continue to invite hostile forces in to mediate in a way where often people wind up dead. And my guess is that some of these poor white folks have people that are participating in underground economies because they've been thrust out of the economy that was traditional. And they're probably participating in some of the same activities that they expect their brown neighbors to be participating in just to get by. But they know that under the veil of whiteness, they get to be not arrested and harassed for doing the same kind of labor. The other question I have is, what would it look like if people started to develop more relationship in community with each other and began to protect their own neighborhoods? It's a very complex question to ask. I've been talking to some people who are involved in a community defense formation in Minneapolis, and their question emerged around the lumpen element. And for those who aren't familiar with that term, that would be the street cats, the guys who are on the corner, maybe participating in some type of underground economy that's not legal to support their livelihoods. And often people who participate in underground economies like this are armed because they have something of value, and there are other people that they're in competition with who might come and try to take it from them. And in that, because it's an underground economy in that system, they can't rely on the police. They don't call the police. And the way that we've been historically taught to think about people engaged in this activity is that they're a threat to the safety of the community. And that's because the reality is when armed people are in competition over an economy, there are often skirmishes that wind up where people are shooting. And so this is the type of scenario that we think of when we think about Chicago, right? And all the gun violence. This is the kind of thing we think about when we think about gang wars in LA and so on and so forth. But the reality is, what I see when I look at that is I see a base of people who are already militarized and militant, who are already committed to working outside of the system in a way to support themselves, their families, each other. And the question is, what would it take to begin a conversation to start to incorporate the efforts of those people into the efforts of the broader community to be defended in a way that could eliminate the threat factor that might be part of the culture of the people who are involved in the underground economy? That's what has to happen ultimately, is that people who right now are afraid of each other, who are protecting their self-interest, need to understand that their common interest is going to work for the benefit of everybody in that community. And it's only when that conversation starts to happen, and it's a struggle, it's an organizing conversation, it's a hard conversation to have, because people have to get over their fears and they have to learn to respect each other in ways that they're not used to doing right now. But it's only when that can begin to happen that we start to see politicization move in a way where we don't need the police Matter of fact, we don't want the police around here. And maybe we, when we step to the police and we say, hey, we got this under control, and they see that people are actually organized and they are trained and they are armed, then the police go, you know what? This isn't a place where we should be anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And they move on. And that's what I hear is actually happening in certain parts of Minneapolis. People are organizing themselves. They're having these conversations, and the police are forced to, not through violent force, but through practical consideration, they're forced to have to leave those people alone.
And the Oregon legislature has been talking about decriminalizing all drugs, which could have a very positive impact in many regards. And combine that with like a $2,000 a month universal basic income, and I'll bet the crime rate would go down to like 1% of what it is now.
Yeah, yeah.
Mike, you're just to change the subject fairly radically. Your video Earthbound is just incredible. I mean the whole technical aspect of it, but all the music and the sort of the particularly staccato delivery of your lines. I mean the whole thing, everything about it, I think is fantastic. It's an environmentalist anthem. That whole product, the song and the video. And I know it's one of those classic stupid questions, but did you write the lyrics after coming up with the music for that one in particular, or is there a process when you write lyrics? Are you usually writing lyrics to some kind of a musical backdrop already before you start with lyric writing, or the lyrics come first?
Both ways, both and, not either or. So with that song, I had the beat, and I sat on that beat. I had that beat for a year, and I was like, what should I do with this? I really love this beat, but I wasn't sure what direction to go with it. And it was actually, somebody wrote to me, there was actually economic incentive, where somebody emailed me and said, hey, I know you do socially conscious and politically conscious hip hop, and this might be a stretch, but we're looking for somebody that can write about ecological crisis and environmental consciousness. So could you produce a poem, and we'll pay you to come up to Seattle and speak at this conference and deliver the poem. And so I was like, okay, this is great. I'm going to get paid to write about the type of things I'm already thinking about and concerned about. So I wrote the lyrics when I revisited that beat and said, I'm going to use this beat because the musicality of the beat is such that I think it invites the listener in. It's not something that's too hard. It's not something that there's musical dynamics in it, so it's not too monotonous. And so I said, this is good. This gives me the opportunity to have a musical backdrop to talk about some hard things. And now I'm going to try to talk about these things in a way that, again, is inviting to the listener. And so therefore, you have the staccato kind of cadence of the lyrics that I think is actually, even though I'm not talking about strippers and popping Xanax and whatever, it's a cadence that is, you'll find it in a lot of popular hip hop. And so it was all intentional. I didn't get the job. Somebody else got the job, but I wound up with this song called Earthbound. So that's how it happened.
Excellent. I was totally right about my guess that the music came first with that one. You can sometimes just tell that there's something about the rhythm of the delivery that you are sitting on the music first for a while. Yeah. And is it, it's some of the best material is commissioned, would you say? Oddly enough, when somebody actually cares enough that they want you to write about a particular thing, it's really motivating, isn't it? Like,
well, I'll tell you, you know, this is a conversation that I had to have yesterday with somebody, because there's, you know, there's a contest going to rewrite the state song of Oregon. Oregon had a state song. I didn't know, but I guess if you look at the lyrics of the original song, it's pretty racist because it represents the mindset of the white settler. And there's talk about, you know, killing Indians and something.
In the song?
I don't think the lyrics are that explicit, but I think it's talking about being rewarded for clearing the land, so to speak, and that there's some implicit white settler shit in the song, is what I'm saying. which is common. That's, you know, if you look at the state seals of a lot of the states, there's
imagery, and the national anthem,
all of that, right?
Yep.
It's pretty much oriented to white power. But that said, some people were interested in doing a project around, a statewide project around organizing people to write a song that's more inclusive and reflective of the current realities. And it's going to take a significant amount of labor. But during the conversation, I spoke up about the fact that if I was going to participate in the organizing effort and manage some of the project, that I would have to be paid for it. Because the fact of the matter is, I don't have the capacity to take on free work. My plate is too full. And what being paid allows me to do is it allows me to prioritize the time in a manner that justifies my use of the time. Because I still have a family, I still have to find time to do the unpaid labor of creating the art that is central to my professional, you know, career. And I also have to have time for myself to do things like eat food and think and sleep and rest and maybe go hiking, you know? And so I say that to say, I understand and I'm still motivated to do a lot of free labor for the right reasons, but I'm also living life in a way where I will speak up and I will assert that if the work is gonna get done and ensure that it's gonna get done, then I'm going to treat myself like I would treat the plumber who has to come fix the toilet.
I totally feel the same way for what it's worth. And it's interesting that I think a long time ago when I was kind of starting out, I was doing a lot of free gigs until I started, you know, all sorts of different, you know, free gigs in the broad sense of the term gig. But then I stopped doing so much free stuff because I realized that the people who want you to do stuff for free, they're not very serious about what they're doing. And the people who actually get it together to fundraise, you know, whether from their own pockets or from whatever, however sources, then if they can get together a few $100, then you know they're serious. And then you know that if it's a gig, it's going to have a bigger audience because they're going to do good promotion. And if it's a recording session, they're going to have a real microphone. You know, it's just a whole different thing. Has that been kind of, yeah.
Yeah. And also, you know, on an interpersonal level, if you have people that you love that are part of your life, like many of us do, if we're fortunate, we have partners, we have children, those people, you have to.
To spend time with them, huh?
We're accountable to the people who support us.
They need support to eat.
Us. Yeah, and they support us because they give us the love and reinforcement and time that we need to be a whole person to go out and do the things that we do. And when we're looking at them and they're like, oh, you have to leave again? Or, oh, you're not in bed because you're up writing? Somehow we have to justify that existence to the people who support us through love, right? Mm. And part of the way that we justify the time we spend with our art is by being paid something that we get to take home and reinvest into the time we get to spend with the people we love.
Yeah.
It's true, man.
Yeah. Very important. Mike Crenshaw, thanks so much for joining me for another conversation here. Hope I can get you back to talk about the few things that might happen between now and say like at the end of August, you know.
There's going to be so much. And you know, I've got, speaking of music, I do have some new releases. I'm trying to wrap up the artwork. And so there'll be some new things to discuss and I can probably share some things with you.
Great.
So that you can get familiar with the songs and then maybe we can talk about some of that stuff.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Yes, yes. Good, good. And maybe eventually I can figure out how to, you know, play videos in the course of these live stream things too. You know, I haven't gotten technical enough to branch out into the pre-recorded music realm, but I'll have to work on that.
Yeah. And maybe sometime you hit me once years ago, you said, what do you think about doing like a folk punk hip hop band? But
I'd love to.
Maybe what we could do is we could just start by writing a song together.
Excellent plan.
See what happens. Yeah.
Definitely. I'll talk to you in a few minutes when we're off off air.
All right. Have a good day. Thanks, David.
You too, Mike. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And thanks for tuning into this conversation with Mike Crenshaw. You can find this and other discussions with David in archived form in various locations, such as the Discussions with David playlist on youtube.com/drovix, at patreon.com/davidrovix, at soundcloud.com/davidrovix, and on any podcasting platform if you search for the podcast This Week with David Rovix. The music, the live stream broadcasts, and the podcasts are all free, but if you want to support my journalistic and musical efforts, plus have access to some exclusive offerings just for patrons, please join my Community Supported Art Program, or CSA, at davidrovix.com/subscribe or patreon.com/davidrovix. If you're somewhere in the region of Portland, Oregon, please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up for text notifications to be part of Portland Emergency Eviction Response to help us mobilize against the coming waves of evictions. I just started a crowdfunder for an album project, also known as a musician and audio engineer employment scheme. You can check that out at davidrovix.com/pandemic sessions. Hope to see you again soon here in the Matrix and out on the streets. Don't pay the rent and don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. Bye for now.